4.2 blank. 4.3 The summer of 1962 began with a trip to a far-off place and ended with a second trip to an even farther far-off place. Four back-and-forth journeys by air that took Ferguson to California by himself and to Paris with his mother and Gil, where he spent a total of 2.5 weeks not having to worry about running into Andy Cohen. In between his travels, he stayed at home on Riverside Drive, avoiding the Thalia, but going to as many old and new movies as he could, participating in 2 outdoor basketball leagues and, at Gil's suggestion, reading 20th century American literature for the first time. Babbitt, Manhattan Transfer, Late in August, In Our Time, The Great Gatsby. But for the 15-year-old Ferguson, who never once laid eyes on Andy Cohen during the months between his freshman and sophomore years, the most memorable part of the summer was traveling in airplanes for the first time and seeing what he saw and doing what he did in California and Paris. Memorable, of course, did not mean that all his memories were good ones, but even the worst one, the memory that continued to cause him the most pain, had come from an experience that proved to be instructive to him. And now that he had learned his lesson, he hoped he would never make the same mistake again. The California trip was a present from his Aunt Mildred, the once elusive and mysterious relative who had boycotted her sister's wedding in 1959 and had appeared to want nothing more to do with the family. But she had returned to New York twice since that nasty, inexplicable snub, once for her father's funeral in 1960 and again for her mother's funeral in 1961. And now she was back in the fold, on reasonably good terms with her sister again, and on excellent terms with her new brother-in-law. And so changed was her attitude that on the second visit she willingly showed up for a dinner at the apartment on Riverside Drive, where one of the guests was her ex-husband, Paul Sandler, Ferguson's former uncle, who had remained a fast friend of the Adler-Schneiderman household. Paul Sandler, in the company of his second wife, no less, a forthright, outspoken painter by the name of Judith Bogat. And Ferguson was impressed by how relaxed and comfortable his aunt seemed at that dinner, trading pleasantries with her ex as if there were no history between them, discussing the progress of the not-yet-completed Lincoln Center with Gil, actually deigning to compliment her sister on some of her recent photographs, and asking Ferguson all sorts of friendly, challenging questions about films and basketball and the agonies of adolescence, which led to a sudden, spontaneous invitation to visit her in Palo Alto, on her dime, and thus it was arranged that her nephew would fly out to spend a week with her after the end of the school year. 2 hours later, as the last of the dinner guests dispersed into the night, Ferguson asked his mother why Aunt Mildred seemed so different now. So happy. "I think she's in love," his mother said. "I don't know any of the details, but she mentioned a person named Sidney a couple of times, and I have a feeling they might be living together now. You can never tell with Mildred, but there's no question she's in a good mood these days." He was expecting his aunt to meet him at the airport, but someone else was waiting for him in the terminal the day he landed in San Francisco. A younger woman of perhaps 25 or 26 who stood by the exit door holding up a copy of Mildred's book on George Eliot, a diminutive, lively-looking, almost pretty girl with short brown hair, dressed in blue jeans rolled up at the bottoms, a red and black checkered shirt, two-toned alligator boots with pointy tips, and a yellow bandana cinched around her neck. Ferguson's first Westerner, a genuine cowgirl. The Sydney Ferguson's mother had told him about was in fact Sydney, S-Y-D-N-E-Y, a Sydney with the last name of Milbanks. And as the young woman accompanied the weary traveler out of the terminal and led him toward her car in the parking lot, she explained that Mildred was teaching summer classes that quarter and had been held up at a department meeting on campus, but she would be joining them for dinner at the house in a couple of hours. Ferguson inhaled his first whiff of California air and said, "Are you the cook?" "Cook, housekeeper, back rubber, and bedmate," Sydney replied. "I hope you aren't shocked." The truth was that Ferguson did feel a little shocked, or at least surprised, or perhaps confused, since this was the first time he had heard of two people of the same sex living together, and no one had ever told him or dropped the smallest hint that his aunt secretly preferred the bodies of women to the bodies of men. The divorce from Uncle Paul had an explanation now, or seemed to have an explanation. But even more interesting was that Sydney, the cowgirl, saw no point in hiding the truth from him. And there was something admirable about her candor, he thought. It was good not to feel ashamed of being different. And so, rather than admit to being a little shocked or confused by this unexpected revelation, Ferguson smiled and said, "No, not at all. I'm just happy that Aunt Mildred isn't alone anymore." It took about 40 minutes to drive from the San Francisco airport to the house in Palo Alto. And as Sydney tooled down the freeway in her pale green Saab, she told Ferguson about how she had met Mildred some years back when she was looking for a new place to live and had rented the garage apartment attached to her house. In other words, it had been an accidental meeting, something that never would have happened if she hadn't stumbled across four lines of minuscule type in a newspaper. But not long after she settled in, they had become friends, and a couple of months after that, they had fallen in love. Neither one of them had been with a woman before. But there they were, Sydney said, a university professor and a third-grade schoolteacher, a woman in her early 40s and a woman in her mid-20s, a Jew from New York and a Methodist from Sandusky, Ohio, swept up in the greatest romance of their lives. The most confounding thing about it, Sydney continued, was that she had never thought about women in the past. She had always been a girl who was crazy for boys. And even now, after being shacked up with a woman for close to 3 years, she still didn't think of herself as a lesbian. She was simply a person in love with another person. And because that other person was beautiful and entrancing and unlike anyone else in the world, what difference did it make if she was in love with a man or a woman? She probably shouldn't have been talking to him in that way. No doubt there was something inappropriate and perhaps indecent for a grown woman to be sharing such confidences with a 15-year-old boy. But the 15-year-old Ferguson was thrilled by her openness. At no point in his adolescence had any adult ever been so honest with him about the chaos and ambiguities of erotic life. And even though he had only just met Sydney Milbanks, Ferguson decided that he liked her, that he liked her enormously, and because he himself had been wrestling with these same matters for the past several months, struggling to figure out where he stood on the boy-girl spectrum of desire, and whether he belonged in the zone of boys and girls, or boys and boys, or girls and boys interchangeably, he felt that this California cowgirl, this lover of both men and women, this person who had just entered his life and was taking him to his aunt's house in Palo Alto might be someone he could talk to without fear of being laughed at or insulted or misunderstood. "I agree," Ferguson said. "It doesn't matter if it's a man or a woman." "Not many people think that way, Archie. You know that, don't you?" "Yes, I know, but I'm not many people. I'm just me, and the weird thing about me so far is that the only sex I've ever had was with another boy." "That's very common for people your age, so common that you shouldn't worry about it, just in case you have been worrying. What's a boy to do, right?" Ferguson laughed. "I hope you enjoyed it, at least," Sydney said. "I enjoyed it, but after a while I didn't enjoy him, so I put a stop to it. And now you're wondering, what's next? Until I get a chance to do it with a girl, I won't really know what's next. It's not much fun being 15, is it?" "It has its good points, I suppose." "Really? Name one." Ferguson closed his eyes, paused for a long moment, and then turned to her and said, "The best thing about being 15 is that you don't have to be 15 for more than a year." There were no flies or mosquitoes in California, and the Palo Alto air smelled like a box of cough drops. Spicy sweet throat lozenges with a eucalyptus flavor because eucalyptus trees turned out to be everywhere, giving off an all-pervasive scent that seemed to cleanse your nasal passages every time you inhaled. Vicks VapoRub dispensed free of charge into the Northern California atmosphere for the health and happiness of the human population. The town, on the other hand, felt bizarre to Ferguson, less a real place than the idea of a place, a quasi-urban, quasi-suburban outpost designed by a master planner with no tolerance for dirt or imperfection, which made the town seem dull and artificial, quaint little Spookville inhabited by people with trim haircuts and straight white teeth, all of them dressed in good-looking, up-to-the-minute, casual clothes. Luckily, Ferguson didn't spend much time there, going once to shop for groceries with Sydney in the largest, cleanest, most beautiful supermarket he had ever seen, once to a filling station to put gas in her primitive lawnmower engine Saab, 7 parts gasoline to 1 part oil, both poured directly into the tank, and twice to the local art house theater to watch films in that week's Carol Lombard Festival, My Man Godfrey, To Be or Not to Be. Primarily because Sydney believed Mildred bore a strong resemblance to Carol Lombard, which, upon reflection, Ferguson granted was more or less true. But what splendid comedies those films were, and now that he had seen them, not only did Ferguson have a new actress to admire, but a new insight into Aunt Mildred, who had laughed harder at those films than anyone else. And since Ferguson's mother had often told him how her big sister had mocked her in the old days for liking movies so much, he wondered if love hadn't softened his aunt's attitude toward what she had once called trashy, low-life entertainment, or if she had always been a hypocrite, lording it over her sister by asserting her superior taste and intelligence in all things while privately reveling in the same trash everyone else did. Twice, the three of them left Palo Alto and went on all-day excursions in Mildred's black Peugeot, first to Mount Tamalpais on Wednesday, with a return trip down the coast that included a 2-hour pause at Bodega Bay, where they had dinner in a restaurant overlooking the water, and a Saturday outing to San Francisco that triggered dozens of tourist yelps from the startled Ferguson as they drove up and down the steep hills, and then stopped for lunch at a Chinese restaurant where he ate dim sum for the first time, food that tasted so good his eyes filled with tears as he gorged himself on 3 different varieties of dumplings. Tears of thanks, tears of joy, tears of hot sauce surging through his nostrils. But for the most part, Mildred was busy with her classes and student conferences that week, which meant that until she came home for dinner at 6 or 6:30, Ferguson was either alone or with Sydney, although far less alone than with Sydney, who was on a 10-week vacation from her school, just as he was from his, and because Sydney professed to being the laziest person in the world, a title Ferguson had always thought belonged exclusively to him, they spent the bulk of their time together, sprawled out on blankets in the yard behind the house, which was a 1-story stucco cottage with a terracotta roof, or inside the house, which was pleasantly cluttered with books and records, and was the first house Ferguson had ever set foot in that had no television. And as the days passed and he got to know Sydney better, he was intrigued that the almost pretty cowgirl was turning into the pretty cowgirl, and then the very pretty cowgirl, for the longish nose he had first seen as a defect now struck him as alluring and distinctive, and the blue-gray eyes that had once seemed so ordinary now looked alive and full of feeling. He had known her for just a few days, but he already felt they were friends, in much the same way he imagined that he and Cousin Francie had once been friends in the long-ago world before the Newark fire. So it went for the first 5 days of his visit, that is, the 3 days that weren't spent traveling around in Mildred's car. The quiet, uneventful days when Ferguson and Sydney would lie around in the backyard and talk about anything that came into their heads. Not just about the question of who fucked whom and why, but also about Sydney's girlhood in Ohio and Ferguson's double boyhood in New Jersey and New York, about the different ways in which stories were told in books and movies, and the pleasures and frustrations of teaching young children, about how Mildred felt both excited and nervous to have her nephew staying in the house, excited for all the obvious reasons, but nervous because she was hesitant to expose her sister's son to the way she was living now, which explained why she had asked Sydney to sleep in the garage apartment while Ferguson was with them, to spare the boy any embarrassment, as she had put it, meaning her own embarrassment, and when Ferguson asked Sidney why she had gone ahead and told him the real story just minutes after picking him up at the airport, the pretty cowgirl said, "I hate dissembling, that's why. It means you don't believe in your own life, or that you're scared of your own life, and I believe in my life, Archie, and I don't want to be scared of it." Around 4 o'clock, they would pull themselves together and shuffle into the kitchen to start making dinner, continuing to talk as they chopped onions and peeled potatoes. The two of them 12 years apart in age, which paradoxically was much larger than the 15 years that stood between Sidney and Mildred. But for all that, he and Sidney were closer in spirit than Sidney was to Mildred, Ferguson felt. Two mutts as opposed to the thoroughbred from Stanford University, a question of temperament more than of age, he supposed. But when Mildred finally returned to the house at 6 or 6:30, Ferguson would pay close attention to how the two women acted around him, aware that Mildred was pretending not to be involved with Sidney in the way he knew she was, while Sidney stubbornly ignored the injunction to pretend, showering endearments on his aunt that seemed to make Mildred more and more uncomfortable as the days went on, the darlings and angels and sugar pies that no doubt would have pleased her if he hadn't been sitting at the table with them. And after 5 days, Ferguson sensed they were locked in a silent quarrel that had been provoked by his presence. And on the evening of the 6th day, which was the next to last day of his visit, the increasingly anxious and out of sorts Mildred drank too much wine at dinner and eventually lost her composure. Lost it because she wanted to lose it and needed the wine to push her over the edge. And the surprising thing about her outburst was that she didn't lash out at Sidney, but at her nephew, as if he were the cause of her troubles. And the moment the assault began, Ferguson understood that Sidney had been talking behind his back, that the cowgirl had betrayed him. "Since when have you been a Bulgarian, Archie?" Mildred asked. "A Bulgarian?" Ferguson replied. "What are you talking about? You've read Candide, haven't you? Don't you remember the Bulgarians?" "I'm not following you." "The buggering Bulgarians? That's where the word comes from, you know. Bulgar, bugar, bugger." "And what's that supposed to mean?" "Men fucking other men up the ass." "I still don't know what you're talking about. A little birdie told me you've been buggering other boys, or maybe other boys have been buggering you." "A little birdie?" At that point, Sidney jumped into the conversation and said, "Leave him alone, Mildred. You're drunk." "No, I'm not," Mildred said. "I'm mildly intoxicated, and that gives me the right to tell the truth. And the truth of the matter is, my beloved Archie, the truth is that you're too young to be going down that road now, and if you don't get a grip on yourself, you'll turn into a queer before you know it, and then there'll be no turning back. There are enough queers in this family already, I'm afraid, and the last thing we need is another one." Without uttering a word, Ferguson stood up from the table and started walking out of the room. "Where are you going?" Mildred asked. "Away from you," Ferguson said. "You have no idea what you're talking about, and I don't have to sit here listening to your crap." "Oh, Archie," Mildred said, "come on back. We need to talk." "No, we don't. I'm done talking with you." Ferguson stomped off, struggling to push back the tears that were gathering in his eyes. And when he came to the corridor at the front of the house, he turned left and walked down the tiled hallway until he reached the guest bedroom at the far end. In the distance, he could hear Mildred and Sidney arguing behind him, but he didn't listen to what they were saying, and by the time he entered the room and shut the door, their voices were too muffled for him to make out the words. He sat down on the bed, put his hands over his face, and started to sob. "No more sharing of secrets," he said to himself. "No more unguarded confessions. No more trusting in people who didn't deserve to be trusted." If he couldn't say what he wanted to say in front of everyone in the world, he would keep his mouth shut and say it to no one. He understood now why his mother had always looked up to her older sister, and why she had always been disappointed by her. "So much intelligence there," he said to himself. "So much humor when she had a mind to be humorous. So much generosity when she had a mind to be generous. But Mildred could be mean, meaner than any other person on earth. And now that Ferguson had been scalded by that meanness, he wanted nothing to do with her, and would henceforth cross her off his list. No more Aunt Mildred, and no more Sidney Milbanks, who had shown such promise as a friend. But how could you be friends with someone who seemed to be your friend but wasn't? A moment later, Sidney was knocking on the door. He knew it was Sidney because she was calling out his name, asking if he was all right, asking if she could come in and talk to him. But Ferguson said no. He didn't want to see her or talk to her. He wanted her to leave him alone. But unfortunately, the door had no lock, and Sidney came in anyway, cracking open the door until he could see her face and the tears that were rushing down her cheeks. And then she was all the way in, apologizing for what she had done, saying, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." "Fuck off, little birdie," Ferguson said. "I don't care if you're sorry or not, just leave me alone." "I'm a stupid blabbermouth," Sidney said. "Once I start talking, I don't know when to stop. I didn't mean it, Archie. I swear I didn't." "Of course you meant it. Breaking a secret is bad enough, but lying is even worse. So don't start lying too, okay?" "What can I do to help, Archie?" "Nothing. Just go. Please, Archie, let me do something for you. Besides getting you out of this room, there's only one thing I want. Tell me what it is, and it's yours. A bottle of scotch. You're not serious. A bottle of scotch, preferably unopened, and if it is open, as close to full as possible. It'll make you sick. Listen, Sidney, either you bring it in to me, or I go out and get it myself. But I'd rather not go out there right now because my aunt is in the other room, and I don't want to see her." "All right, Archie, give me a few minutes." So Ferguson got his scotch, a half-empty bottle of Johnny Walker Red, hand-delivered to him by Sidney Milbanks, a half-empty bottle that Ferguson chose to think of as half-full. And once Sidney left the room again, he began drinking the scotch and went on drinking it in small, slow swallows until the first slivers of dawn cut through the slats of the Venetian blinds and the bottle was empty. And for the second time that year, Ferguson puked up his binge on the floor of another person's house and passed out. Paris was different. Paris was all about the sensation of being in Paris and roaming around the streets with his mother and Gil, about attending the opening of his mother's first solo exhibition at the Galerie Vinteuil on the Rue Bonaparte, about the 2 evenings spent with an old friend of Gil's named Vivian Schreiber, about discovering that in spite of his B's and B-pluses at the Riverside Academy, he had learned enough French to be able to hold his own in the language, about deciding that Paris was the city where he eventually wanted to live. After a summer of watching old and new French films, it was impossible to walk through the streets of Montmartre without thinking he might run into the young Antoine Doinel from the 400 Blows, to walk down the Champs-Élysées without hoping to brush past the gorgeous Jean Seberg as she strolled back and forth in her white T-shirt, hawking copies of the Herald Tribune, the same paper his stepfather worked for, or to glide along the banks of the Seine and glance over at the bouquinist's stalls without remembering the roly-poly bookstore owner who dives into the water to rescue the vagabond Michel Simon in Boudou saved from drowning. Paris was the movie of Paris, an agglomeration of all the Paris movies Ferguson had seen, and how inspiriting it was to find himself in the real place now, real in all of its sumptuous and stimulating reality, and yet to walk around feeling that it was an imaginary place as well, a place both in his head and out in the air that encircled his body, a simultaneous here and there, a black-and-white past and a full-color present. And Ferguson took pleasure in shuttling between the two of them, his thoughts moving so fast at times that the two blurred into one. It was unusual for an exhibition to open at the end of August, when half the population of Paris was gone from the city. But that was the only available slot in the gallery's schedule, August 20th to September 20th. And Ferguson's mother had gladly accepted it, knowing that the director had done everything he could to fit her in. 48 pictures in all, about half from previously published work and half from a new book that would be coming out next year, Silent City. Ferguson had already been told that he was the subject of one of the photographs. But still, he found it somewhat destabilizing to see himself hanging on the far wall when he entered the gallery. The familiar old picture his mother had taken of him 7 years ago, in the pre-Gill days when they were living together in the apartment on Central Park West. A long shot of him from behind as he sat on the living room floor watching Laurel and Hardy on television. His 8-year-old torso enveloped in a striped, short-sleeved T-shirt. And the moving thing about the photo, which bore the one-word title Archie, was the curve of his skinny back, each vertebra of his spine protruding into the shirt to create the bumpy, bony effect of childhood vulnerability. The portrait of an exposed being, a little boy locked in total concentration before the bowler-headed buffoons on screen, and therefore oblivious to everything else around him. And how proud Ferguson was of his mother for having produced such a good picture, which could have been nothing more than a banal snapshot, but wasn't, as was the case with the 47 other pictures on view that evening. And as Ferguson looked at his young, faceless self, sitting on the floor of an apartment they no longer occupied, he couldn't help going back to the months of the curious interregnum and the Hilliard School disaster, and remembering how his mother had ultimately replaced God in his mind as the supreme being, the human incarnation of the divine spirit, a flawed and mortal being prone to the sulks and restless confusions that afflict all human beings. But he had worshipped his mother because she was the one person who never let him down. And no matter how many times he had disappointed her or proved himself to be less than he should have been, she had never not loved him and would never not love him to the end of her life. Pretty and jittery, Ferguson said to himself as he watched his mother smile and nod and shake hands with the guests at the vernissage, which had attracted about 100 people in spite of the August holiday. A large, noisy crowd crammed into the smallish exhibition space of the gallery. Noisy because the 8 or 9 dozen people who had come there were apparently more interested in talking to one another than in looking at the pictures on the walls. But this was the first opening of any kind that Ferguson had attended, and he was unfamiliar with the protocols of such gatherings, the sophisticated hypocrisies of supposed art lovers coming to an art show in order to ignore the artworks on display. And if the young barman serving drinks at a table in a corner of the room hadn't been kind enough to pour Ferguson a glass of vin blanc, followed by a second glass 20 minutes later, Ferguson might have walked out in protest, since this was his mother's big moment, and he wanted everyone there to be fixed on Rose Adler's work, to be transfixed by it to such a degree that all of them would be hammered into a state of speechless awe. And when that failed to happen, Ferguson stood in the corner, feeling ticked off and let down, too inexperienced to understand that the small red dots posted next to the frames on the walls meant those pictures had already been sold, and that his mother was in excellent spirits that evening, not the least put off by the chatter and noise of those rude, ignorant people. Midway through his second vin blanc, Ferguson saw Gill slicing through the crowd with his arm around a woman's shoulder. The two of them were moving in his direction, steadily advancing toward the drinks table in spite of the intervening bodies, and when they drew close enough for Ferguson to see that they were both smiling, it occurred to him that the woman must have been Gill's old friend, Vivian Schreiber. Gill had already told him something about her, but Ferguson hadn't been paying much attention, and had retained little of the story, which was a rather complicated one, he remembered, having to do with the war and Vivian's older brother, Douglas Gant or Grant, who had served in Gill's intelligence unit and was his closest friend. And somehow or other, Gill had pulled the strings that allowed Vivian, the much younger sister of his much younger army comrade, to enter France in September 1944, just 1 month after the liberation of Paris, and 3 months after she graduated from college in the United States. Why Vivian had needed to go to France was unclear to Ferguson, but not long after she got there, she married Jean-Pierre Schreiber, a French citizen born of German-Jewish parents in 1903, which made him 20 years older than Vivian, who had managed to avoid arrest by the Germans and/or the Vichy police, by traveling to neutral Switzerland just days before the fall of France. And according to what Gill had told Ferguson, Schreiber was rich, or had been rich, or soon became rich again because of his family's resurrected wine export business, or wine growing business, or wine bottle manufacturing business, or some other commercial enterprise that had nothing to do with the harvesting or selling of grapes. No children, Gill had said, but a successful marriage that lasted until the end of 1958, when the trim and youthful Schreiber unexpectedly dropped dead while running to catch a plane at Orly Airport, which had turned Vivian into a young widow. And now that she had sold off her husband's share of the business to his two nephews, she was a wealthy young widow, and, he added, the most charming and intelligent woman in all of Paris, a great friend. All these facts, or partial facts, or possible anti-facts, were rolling around in Ferguson's head as Gill and Vivian Schreiber came nearer to where he was standing. His first impression of the great friend was that she ranked among the three or four most beautiful women he had ever seen. Then, as she came closer and he could make out her features with more precision, he realized that she wasn't beautiful so much as impressive. 38-year-old woman who projected a radiant aura of assurance and ease, whose clothes and makeup and hair were so elegantly and unpretentiously arranged that they seemed to have required no effort on her part to achieve the effect they achieved, who didn't simply occupy space in the room where everyone was standing, but seemed to dominate the room, to own the room, as she no doubt owned every room she happened to enter anywhere in the world. A moment later, Ferguson was shaking her hand and looking into her large brown eyes and smelling the good smells of the perfume that hovered around her body as he listened to her unusually deep voice say how honored she was to meet him. Honored? And all of a sudden, everything began to glow more brightly in Ferguson. For surely Vivian Schreiber was an exceptional person, a full-fledged movie star sort of person. And knowing her was bound to make a difference in his sadly unexceptional 15-year-old's life. Vivian was present at the dinner that followed the opening, but there were 12 people sitting at the table in the restaurant, and Ferguson was too far away from her for them to have a chance to talk, so he contented himself with watching her throughout the meal, noting how carefully the others around her listened to what she said whenever she contributed something to the conversation. And once or twice she looked over at him and saw that he was looking at her and smiled. But other than that, and other than the words spreading at his end of the table, that Vivian had bought 6 of his mother's photographs, including Archie, there was no contact between them that night. 3 nights later, when Ferguson, his mother, and Gill met Vivian for dinner at La Coupole, there were no impediments to the give and take of talking and listening. But for some reason, Ferguson felt shy and overwhelmed in Vivian's presence and said little, preferring to listen to the conversation of the 3 adults, who had much to say on any number of subjects, including his mother's photographs, which Vivian praised as sublimely human and uncannily direct, and Vivian's older brother, Douglas Gant, or Grant, who worked as a marine biologist in La Jolla, California, and the progress Gill had made on his book about Beethoven's string quartets, and Vivian's own work on a book she had been writing about an 18th-century painter named Chardin, who was still unknown to Ferguson at that point. But by the time he left Paris 4 days later, he had made it his business to see every Chardin at the Louvre, and had absorbed the mysterious fact that looking at a glass of water or an earthen jug on a painted canvas could be more involving and significant to the soul than looking at the crucified Son of God on a similar painted rectangle. But even though Ferguson was mostly silent at the dinner, he was alert and happy, fully engaged in what the others were saying, and how much he enjoyed sitting in La Coupole, that huge, cavernous restaurant with the white tablecloths and the brisk waiters in their black and white uniforms, and all the people around him talking at once, so many people talking and looking at one another at the same time. The heavily rouged women with their little dogs, and the somber men chain-smoking their gitane, and the outlandishly decked-out couples who seemed to be auditioning for a play in which they were the central characters, the Montparnasse scene, as Vivian called it, the never-ending jeu du regard. And there was Giacometti, she said, and there was the actor who performed in all of Beckett's plays. And there was another artist whose name meant nothing to Ferguson, but who must have been a famous figure known to everyone in Paris. And because they were in Paris, his mother and Gil let him drink wine at dinner. Such a luxury to be in a place where no one cared about how old you were. And several times, during the 2 hours they spent at their corner table in the restaurant, Ferguson sat back and looked at his mother and Gil and the luminous Vivian Schreiber and found himself wishing the four of them could go on sitting there forever. Afterward, as Gil and his mother were about to put Vivian in a taxi, the young widow took hold of Ferguson's face, kissed him once on each cheek and said, "Come back and see me when you're a little older, Archie. I think we're going to be great friends." Between the trips to California and Paris, there was the hot summer in New York, the outdoor basketball games in Riverside Park, the 4 or 5 nights a week spent in air-conditioned movie theaters, the big and small American novels Gil continued to leave on his bedside table, and the poor planning that had kept him stuck in the city when every one of his school friends had gone somewhere else for July and August, not to mention the 19-year-old Jim, who was working as a counselor at a sleepaway camp in Massachusetts, and the confounding, ever-elusive Amy, who had managed to get herself shipped off to Vermont to take part in a 2-month-long immersion program in French, which was precisely what he should have done, and no doubt would have done, if he hadn't lacked the wit to propose it to his mother and Gil, who almost certainly would have been able to afford the tuition, which Uncle Dan and Aunt Liz could not, but fast-talking Amy had pried loose the necessary cash from her grandmother in Chicago and the old goat in the Bronx, and there she was, sending him jocular, teasing postcards from the New England woods. "Cher cousin, the word con in French doesn't mean what I thought it meant. The English equivalent would be jerk or asshole, not you-know-what. Whereas que, which means tail, also means you-know-what in French. Which reminds me, how is my favorite con man doing in New York these days? Hot enough for you, Archie, or is that pretend sweat I see dripping from your forehead? Baiser à mon bien-aimé, Amy." While Ferguson languished in the torrid drool of Dog Day Manhattan, trapped in yet another loveless stretch of masturbation reveries and grimly persistent wet dreams. The biggest topic in the household that summer was Lincoln Center and Gil's long-term dispute with his colleagues over the new Philharmonic Hall, which would finally be opening on September 23rd. The pus-ridden eyesore, as Ferguson's grandfather used to call it, had been part of the West 60s landscape for as long as Ferguson and his mother had been living in New York. A gigantic 30-acre slum clearance project financed by Rockefeller money that had razed hundreds of buildings and kicked out thousands of people from their apartments to make way for what was being called a new cultural hub. All those mountains of dirt and bricks, all those steam shovels and pile drivers and holes in the ground, all that noise blasting through the neighborhood for all those years. And now that the first building of the 16-acre Lincoln Center complex was nearly done, the controversy was about to erupt into one of the angriest public shouting matches in the city's history. Size versus acoustical balance, arrogance and presumption versus mathematics and reason. And Gil was in the thick of it, because the feud had been provoked by the Herald Tribune, in particular by two of the people he worked with most closely at the paper, arts editor Victor Lowry and fellow music critic Barton Crosetti, who had led an aggressive campaign to expand the number of seats in the original blueprints for the new hall because, they insisted, a great metropolis like New York deserved something bigger and better. Bigger, yes, Gil had argued, but not better, since the acoustical design had been calibrated for an auditorium of 2,400 seats, not 2,600. And even though the architects and engineers responsible for the plan had said the quality of the sound would be different, which was another way of saying worse or unacceptable, the city gave in to the Herald Tribune's demands and increased the size of the hall. Gil saw that capitulation as a defeat for the future of orchestral music in New York, But now that the larger version of the building was almost finished, what could he do but hope the results would be somewhat less disastrous than he feared? And if they weren't less, that is, if the results were fully as bad as he expected them to be, then he would launch a public campaign of his own, he said, and throw himself into an effort to help save Carnegie Hall, which the city was already intending to demolish. The joke in the family that summer was, how do you spell the word hub? Answer, F-L-U-B. Gil could joke about it because the only other option was to feel angry, and walking around with anger inside you was a bad way to live, he told Ferguson. It was pointless and self-destructive and cruel to the people who depended on you not to be angry, especially when the cause of your anger was something you couldn't control. Do you understand what I'm trying to say, Archie? Gil asked. I'm not sure, Ferguson said. I think so. I'm not sure. A subtle reference to Gil's volcanic outburst against Margaret at the old apartment on Central Park West. I think so. An acknowledgement that he had not seen his stepfather lose his temper again on such a grand scale since that night. There could be only two reasons to account for the change in Gil. One, his character had improved over time, or two, his marriage to Ferguson's mother had turned him into a better, calmer, happier man. Ferguson chose to believe the second possibility, not just because he wanted to believe it, but because he knew it was the correct answer. It's not that the issue isn't important to me, Gil went on. My whole life is music. My whole life is writing about the music performed in this town. And if those performances are going to be less good now because of stupid decisions made by wrong-headed but well-meaning people, some of them my friends, I'm sad to say, then of course I'm going to feel angry. So angry that I've even thought of quitting the paper just to let them know how seriously I take this business. But what good would that do me, or you, or your mother, or anyone else? I suppose we could get along without my salary if we had to, but the fact is I love my job and I don't want to quit. You shouldn't quit. There might be some problems over there, but you shouldn't quit. It's not going to last much longer anyway. The Herald Tribune is sinking financially, and I doubt it will hold on for more than another 2 or 3 years. So I might as well go down with the ship, a loyal crew member to the last, standing by the mad captain who steered us into such dangerous waters. You're joking, right? Since when have you known me to joke, Archie? The end of the Herald Tribune. I remember the first time you took me there, and how much I liked it, how much I still like it every time we go to the building together. It's hard to believe it won't exist anymore. I even thought, well, never mind. Thought what? I don't know, that one day, it sounds so idiotic now, that one day I might end up working there too. What a beautiful idea. I'm touched, Archie, deeply touched, but why would a boy with your talents want to be a newspaper man? Not a newspaper man, a movie critic. In the same way you write about concerts, maybe I could write about films. I've always imagined you'd wind up making your own films. I don't think so. But you love movies so much. I love watching them, but I'm not sure I'd enjoy making them. It takes too much time to make a movie, and during that time, you don't have any time left over to watch other movies. Do you see what I'm talking about? If the thing I enjoy most is watching movies, then the best job for me would be to watch as many movies as I can. School had been in session for close to a month when the new hall opened with a gala concert performed by the New York Philharmonic under the direction of Leonard Bernstein, an event considered so important that it was televised by CBS, a live national broadcast beamed into every home in America. In the days that followed, more concerts were performed by some of the most admired symphony orchestras in the country, Boston, Philadelphia, Cleveland, and by the end of the week, both the press and the public had pronounced their verdict on the acoustical qualities of Lincoln Center's flagship venue. Philharmonic flop, read one headline. Philharmonic folly, read another. Philharmonic fiasco, read a third. The double F sound was apparently irresistible to newspaper editors. given how neatly it flew off the tongues of indignant music lovers, professional naysayers, and barroom wags alike. Some people differed, however, claiming the results weren't as bad as all that, and so began the screaming contest between fors and againsts, the uncivil debate that would go on filling the New York air for months and years to come. Ferguson followed these events out of loyalty to Gill, pleased that his stepfather had been on the winning side of the argument, no matter what harm the defective hall would do to the eardrums of the city's classical music patrons. And one Sunday afternoon he even stood in front of Carnegie Hall with Gill and his mother, holding a sign that read, "Please save me." But mostly Ferguson didn't care, and mostly his thoughts were zeroed in on the demands of school and the never-ending quest for love, even when all the newspapers in New York shut down during the printer's strike that lasted from early December to the final day of March, which he generously chose to interpret as a long-deserved rest for Gill. Amy had broken up with last year's boyfriend, the one Ferguson had never met and whose name he had never known. But she had found a new ami intime during her francophone summer in Vermont, someone who lived in New York and therefore was disponible pour les rencontres chaque weekend, which pushed Ferguson out of the running once again, disqualifying him from even considering a new assault on the fortress of Amy's heart. The same held true of the attractive girls at the Riverside Academy, all locked up and out of bounds, just as they had been the year before, which meant that Isabel Kraft was still no more than a phantom sylph running through the forests of his imagination, a figment other writhing in the light of the nocturnal bone, more real than Miss September, perhaps, but not by much. If only Andy Cohen hadn't said those words last spring, Ferguson sometimes thought. If only their simple arrangement hadn't become so messy and impossible. Not that he even liked Andy Cohen anymore, but the way things were shaping up for his sophomore year, those Saturday afternoon romps on West 107th Street were beginning to make sense again, at least when you considered how much better it was to be with someone than with no one. On the other hand, Onan's muse had never come to him in the form of a male body. It was always a female person who crawled under the blankets with him, for when it wasn't Isabel Kraft slipping out of her red bikini and pressing her skin against his skin, it was Amy, or else, and this he found bizarre, it was Sidney Milbanks, the two-faced cowgirl who had stabbed him in the back, or Vivian Schreiber, who had spoken approximately 47 words to him and was old enough to be his mother. But there they were, the two women from his travels across continents and oceans in July and August, and there was nothing he could do to stop either one of them from entering his thoughts at night. The contrast seemed clear enough, a rigid divide between what he wanted and what his circumstances allowed him to have. The soft flesh of women that would necessarily have to be deferred for another year or two, and the stiff cocks of boys that could be savored now if the opportunity ever arose again. The impossible as opposed to the possible, nighttime fantasies as opposed to daytime realities, love on the one hand and adolescent lust on the other. Also neat and unambiguous. But then he discovered that the line was less sharply drawn than he had supposed, that love could exist on either side of that mental boundary and could do to him what the cowgirl said it had done to her. And to understand that about himself, after pushing away the unwanted love of Andy Cohen, came as a shock to Ferguson, and it frightened him so much that he scarcely seemed to know who he was anymore. In late September, he left New York again for yet another far-off place, traveling to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to spend the weekend with his cousin Jim. Not by air this time, but 5.5 hours by land on 2 buses to Boston with a change in Springfield, his first long-distance bus ride anywhere, and then 2 nights sleeping in Jim's dormitory room at MIT, camped out on the bed normally occupied by Jim's roommate, who had left campus on Friday morning and wouldn't be back until Sunday night. The plan was nebulous. Take in the sights, play some one-on-one basketball in the gym on Saturday morning, visit a few labs at MIT, have a look at the Harvard campus, wander around Back Bay and Copley Square in Boston, have lunch and or dinner at Harvard Square, go to a movie at the Brattle Theater. An unstructured, spur-of-the-moment kind of weekend, Jim said, since the purpose of the visit was to hang out and spend some time together, and what they wound up doing was of little importance. Ferguson was thrilled. No, more than thrilled. Out of his skin with anticipation. And the mere thought of spending the weekend with Jim instantly parted the clouds that had been gathering overhead and turned the sky a bright, bright blue. No one was better than Jim. No one was kinder or more generous than Jim. No one was more admirable than Jim. And all during the bus ride to Boston, Ferguson reflected on how lucky he was to have been thrown into the same family as his remarkable step-cousin. He loved him, he said to himself. He loved him to pieces. And he knew that Jim loved him back because of all those Saturday mornings in Riverside Park, teaching the runty 12-year-old how to play round ball when there were 100 other things he could have been doing. He loved him because he had called to invite him to go up to Cambridge for no other reason than to hang out and spend some time together. And now that Ferguson had tasted the pleasures of boy-boy intimacy, there was nothing he wouldn't have done to find himself naked in Jim's arms, to be kissed by Jim, to be fondled by Jim, yes, to be buggered by Jim, which is something that had never happened with a boy from City College last spring. For whatever Jim wanted him to do, he would do, since this was love, a big, burning love that would go on burning for the rest of his life. And if Jim turned out to be the kind of ambidextrous boy he himself seemed to be turning into, which was altogether unlikely, of course, then a kiss from Jim would carry him to the gates of heaven. And yes, those were the words Ferguson said to himself when he thought that thought in the middle of his journey to Boston. The gates of heaven. It was the happiest weekend of his life, and also the saddest. Happy because being with Jim made him feel so protected, so secure in the comforting nimbus of the older boy's calm. And at every moment he could count on being listened to as carefully as he listened to Jim, who never made him feel lesser or lower or left out. The big breakfasts at the little diner across the Charles, the talk about the space program and mathematical puzzles, and the enormous computers that one day would be small enough to fit in your palm. The Bogart double bill of Casablanca and To Have and Have Not at the Brattle Theater on Saturday night. So many things to be thankful for during the long hours they spent with each other between Friday night and Sunday afternoon. But through it all, the constant pain of knowing that the kiss he wanted would never be given to him. That having Jim was also not having Jim. That to have and have not meant never exposing his true feelings without running the risk of perishing in a fire of eternal humiliation. Worst of all, looking at his cousin's naked body in the locker room after one-on-one basketball, standing naked together with no possibility of extending his arm and putting his fingers on the lean, muscular body of his forbidden love, and then, on Sunday morning, Ferguson's brazen ploy to test the waters by walking around the dorm room with no clothes on for more than an hour, tempted to ask Jim if he wanted a rubdown, but not daring to, tempted to sit down on his bed and start jerking off in front of Jim, but not daring to, hoping his nakedness would elicit some response from his thoroughly heterosexual cousin, which, needless to say, it didn't. For Jim was already in love with someone else, a girl from Mount Holyoke named Nancy Hammerstein, who drove in on Sunday to have lunch with them, a perfectly decent and intelligent girl who saw in Jim precisely what Ferguson saw. And so even in his happiness, Ferguson suffered through much sorrow that weekend, aching for the kiss that would never be given to him and knowing how deluded he was even to want it. And as he sat on the bus that carried him back to New York on Sunday, he cried a little bit, then cried a lot, as the sun went down and darkness engulfed the bus. He was crying more and more often these days, he realized. And who was he? He kept asking himself. And what was he? And why on earth did he persist in making life so hard for himself. He would have to get over it or die, and because Ferguson didn't feel ready to die at age 15 and a half, he did what he could to get over it, throwing himself with scattershot fervor into a maelstrom of contradictory pursuits. By the time the Cuban Missile Crisis started and ended 2 weeks later, with no bombs dropped and no wars declared, leaving no war in sight other than the ever-present Cold War of long duration, Ferguson had published his first film review, had smoked his first cigarette, and had lost his virginity to a 20-year-old prostitute in a small brothel on West 82nd Street. The following month, he made the Riverside Academy's varsity basketball team, but as one of only three sophomores on this 10-man squad, he sat on the bench and rarely saw more than 1 or 2 minutes of action per game. Published. The piece wasn't a review, but an overview, a discussion of the equal but contrasting merits of two films Ferguson had been pondering for the past several months. It appeared in the dismal, sloppily printed biweekly school paper called The Riverside Rebel, an 8-page broadsheet that published out-of-date news items about interscholastic athletic events, articles about meaningless school controversies, the declining quality of the cafeteria food, the headmaster's decision to ban the playing of transistor radios in the halls between classes, and poems, short stories, and occasional drawings by the students who fancied themselves poets, short story writers, and artists. Mr. Dunbar, Ferguson's English teacher that year, was the Rebel's faculty advisor, and he encouraged the fledgling cinephile to contribute as many articles as he cared to write, claiming that the paper was in desperate need of new blood, and regular columns on films, books, art, music, and theater would be a step in the right direction. Intrigued and flattered by Mr. Dunbar's request, Ferguson set to work on a piece about The 400 Blows and Breathless, his two favorite French films of the past summer. And now that he had been to France himself, it seemed only natural that he should begin his career as a film critic by writing about the French New Wave. Other than the fact that both films were shot in black and white and set in contemporary Paris, Ferguson argued, they had nothing in common. The two works were radically different in tone, sensibility, and narrative technique, so different that it would be useless to compare them, and even more useless to waste a single moment questioning which was the better film. About Truffaut, he wrote, "Heartbreaking realism, tender but tough-minded, deeply human, rigorously honest, lyrical." About Godard, he wrote, "Jagged and disruptive, sexy, disturbingly violent, funny and cruel, constant in-joke references to American films, revolutionary." No, Ferguson wrote in the final paragraph, he could not come down on the side of one film or the other because he loved them both, in the same way he loved both Jimmy Stewart westerns and Busby Berkeley musicals, loved both Marx Brother comedies and James Cagney gangster films. "Why choose?" he asked. "Sometimes we want to sink our teeth into a nice fat hamburger, and at other times nothing tastes better than a hard-boiled egg or a dry saltine." "Art is a banquet," he concluded, "and every dish on the table is calling out to us, asking to be eaten and enjoyed." Smoked. On Sunday morning, 1 week after Ferguson's trip to Cambridge, the two Schneiderman households jammed their six bodies into a rented station wagon and drove north to Dutchess County, where they stopped for lunch at the Beekman Arms in Rhinebeck and then scattered in several directions throughout the town. As usual, Ferguson's mother disappeared with her camera and was not seen again until it was time to return to New York. Aunt Liz headed off for the main drag to browse in the antique shops, and Gil and Uncle Dan climbed back into the car, saying they wanted to have a look at the autumn foliage, when in fact they were planning to discuss what to do with their declining father, who was in his mid-80s now and suddenly in need of 24-hour palliative care. Neither Ferguson nor Amy had any interest in poking around old furniture stores or looking at the mutating colors of dying leaves, so they turned right when they saw Amy's mother turn left, and kept on walking until they reached the edge of town, where they chanced upon a small hillock that was still covered with green grass, a pleasant little clump of soft ground that seemed to be begging them to sit on it, which they promptly did. And a few seconds later, Amy reached into her pocket, pulled out a pack of unfiltered Camels, and offered Ferguson a cigarette. He didn't hesitate. It was high time he gave one of those cancer sticks a shot, he said to himself. Mr. He-Man, athlete who had never smoked because it was bad for his wind. And of course he coughed after each of the first three puffs. And of course he felt dizzy for a while. And of course Amy laughed because it was funny to see him doing the things all novice smokers inevitably did. But then he settled down and began to get the hang of it. And before long, he and Amy were talking. Talking in a way that hadn't been possible for them in over a year, with no wisecracks or insults or accusations, with all the rancor and built-up resentments gone like the smoke that was gusting from their mouths and vanishing into the autumn air. And then they stopped talking and just sat on the grass, smiling at each other, happy to be friends again and no longer at odds. At which point, Ferguson wrapped his arm around her in a pretend headlock and croaked softly into her ear, "Another cigarette, please." Lost. There was a wicked and exciting boy in the senior class named Terry Mills, a brilliant, good-for-nothing, who knew more about what teenage boys were not supposed to know than anyone else at the school. He was the supplier of scotch for weekend parties, the purveyor of amphetamine pills for those who wanted to fly fast and stay up all night, the dispenser of marijuana for those who preferred a more subdued approach to intoxication, and the panderer who could help you lose your virginity by taking you to the whorehouse on West 82nd Street. One of the richest boys at the Riverside Academy, the plump and sarcastic Terry Mills, lived with his divorced and frequently absent mother in a townhouse between Columbus Avenue and Central Park West. And although there was much about his behavior that Ferguson found repugnant, he also found it difficult not to like him. According to Terry, legions of Riverside Academy boys, both past and present, had left their boyhoods behind them in the rooms of the 82nd Street bordello. It was a long-established tradition, he said, one that he himself had embraced 2 years ago as a sophomore, and now that Ferguson had ascended to the rank of sophomore as well, might he be interested in paying a visit to that enchanted realm of sensual delights. Yes, Ferguson said, of course he would, most certainly would. When could they go? That conversation took place on a Monday afternoon over lunch, the Monday following the Sunday that Ferguson had spent in Rhinebeck smoking cigarettes with Amy. And the following morning, Terry reported that everything had been arranged for Friday afternoon at around 4, which wouldn't pose a problem for Ferguson because his curfew had been extended that year to 6 o'clock. And fortunately, he had the $25 that would be needed to turn him into a man, although Terry was still hoping that Mrs. M., the director of the establishment, could be talked into giving Ferguson a student discount. Not knowing what to expect, since he had no experience of brothels outside of what he had seen in gaudy Technicolor Hollywood westerns, Ferguson walked into the apartment on West 82nd Street with no images in his head, nothing but a blank of uncertainty, zip plus zero minus null. He found himself in one of those large Upper West Side apartments with crumbled plaster and yellowing walls, a once elegant place that had no doubt housed a prominent New York burger and his voluminous family. But who would stop to examine plaster and walls when the first room you entered was a broad living room with 6 young women in it, half a dozen professional lovemakers sitting around on chairs and divans in various stages of undress, 2 of them, in fact, entirely undressed, which made them the first naked women Ferguson had seen in his life. He had to choose. That was a problem because he had no idea which one of the 6 would be the best lovemaker for an unpracticed boy-girl virgin whose sexual history so far had been confined to 1 male partner, and he had to choose quickly because it made him feel uncomfortable to be sizing up those women as if they were packages of fuck meat without brains or souls. And therefore, Ferguson eliminated the 4 partially dressed ones and narrowed it down to a choice between the 2 all-naked ones, figuring there would be no surprises that way when the action began. And suddenly it wasn't difficult at all, since one of the two was a chubby, large-breasted Puerto Rican woman, well past 30, and the other was a good-looking black girl who couldn't have been more than a few years older than Ferguson, a slender, small-breasted sprite with short hair and a long neck and what looked to be remarkably smooth skin, skin that promised to feel better than any skin his hands had ever touched. Her name was Julie. He had already paid his $25 to the rotund, chain-smoking Mrs. M. No discounts for youthful beginners. And because Terry had loudly and crudely announced that Ferguson's, quote, dick had never seen the inside of a pussy, there was no point in pretending he had been down this road before. The road, in this case, being a narrow hallway that led to a cramped, windowless room with a bed, a sink, and a chair in it. And as Ferguson walked down that corridor behind young Julie's sweet swaying behind, the bulge in his pants was steadily growing. So much so that when they entered the room and Julie instructed him to take off his clothes, she looked down at his cock and said, "You sure get hard fast, don't you, kid?" Which pleased Ferguson immensely, knowing that he was virile enough to produce more rapid hard-ons than most of her adult customers. And suddenly he felt happy, not at all nervous or afraid, even if he didn't fully understand the ground rules of the encounter, as when he tried to kiss her on the lips and she jerked her head away, saying, "We don't do that, honey. Gotta save that stuff for your girlfriend." But she didn't mind it when he put his hands on her little breasts or kissed her on the shoulder, and how good it felt when she washed his dick with soap and warm water at the sink, and how much better it felt when he agreed to something called half and half without knowing what it was, fellatio plus copulation. And they lay down on the bed together, and the first half of half and half proved to be so pleasurable that he was afraid he wouldn't make it to the second half. But somehow he did, and that was the best part of the whole adventure, the long hoped for, long dreamed of, long delayed entrance into another person's body, the act of coupling. And so powerful were the sensations of being inside her that Ferguson couldn't hold back anymore and came almost immediately. So fast that he regretted his lack of control, regretted that he hadn't been able to put off the climax by even a few seconds. "Can we do it again?" he asked. Julie burst out laughing, a great gut yawp of hilarity that bounced around the walls of the tiny room. Then she said, "You come, you're done, funny man, unless you have another $25. "I barely have 25 cents, Ferguson said. Julie laughed again. "I like you, Archie," she said. "You're a good-looking boy with a pretty pecker. I think you're the most beautiful girl in New York." "The skinniest, you mean?" "No, the most beautiful." Julie sat up and kissed Ferguson on the forehead. "Come back and see me sometime," she said. "You know the address, and that loud-mouthed friend of yours has the telephone number. Call first to make an appointment. You wouldn't want to show up when I'm not here, would you?" "No, ma'am, not on your life." Sat. Making the varsity team as a sophomore was a reflection of how much Ferguson's game had improved over the summer. The outdoor leagues had been highly competitive, the rosters crammed with poor black kids from Harlem who took their basketball seriously, who knew that being good at basketball meant starting for a high school team, which could mean playing for a college team and a chance to get out of Harlem for good. And Ferguson had worked hard to improve his outside shooting and ball handling, had put in long hours of extra practice with one of the eager kids from Lenox Avenue named Delbert Strawn, a fellow forward on the tougher of the two teams he had played for. And now that he had grown another 2 inches and stood at a sturdy 5'9½", he had advanced from mere proficiency to something close to excellence, with such potent spring in his legs that even at his height he could dunk the ball once in every 2 or 3 tries. The problem with making the varsity as a sophomore, however, was that you were automatically relegated to the second team, which doomed you to spend the season picking up splinters as a lowly bench warmer. Ferguson understood the importance of hierarchies and would have been content with a subordinate role if he hadn't felt that he was a better player than the first-string small forward, a senior by the name of Duncan Niles, sometimes referred to as no-dunk Niles, for, as it happened, he wasn't only just a little better than Niles, he was a lot better. If Ferguson had been the only one who felt that way, it wouldn't have rankled so much, but nearly all the players shared his opinion. None more vociferously than the other proletarian scrubs, among them his old friends from last year's freshman team, Alex Nordstrom and Brian Mashevsky, who were positively disgusted by the coach's decision to put Ferguson on the bench and kept reminding him of how unfairly he was being treated, since the evidence was there for everyone to see. Whenever the first team and the second team squared off in practice scrimmages, Ferguson consistently outshot, out-hustled, and out-rebounded no-dunk Niles. The coach was a perplexing person, half genius and half idiot, and Ferguson never quite managed to figure out where he stood with him. Former backcourt star for St. Francis College in Brooklyn, one of the smallest schools on the metro region's Catholic circuit, Horace Happy Finnegan knew the game thoroughly and taught it well. But in all other respects, his brain seemed to have atrophied into a gummy mass of melted thought wires and burned-out language tubes. "Pair up in threes," he would say to the boys at practice, or "make a circle, men, 365 degrees. And beyond the incessant malapropisms, there were the questions the boys would ask just for the pleasure of seeing him scratch his head, such as, "Hey, coach, do you walk to school or carry your lunch? Or is it hotter in the city or the summer?" Nonsensical beauties that never failed to elicit the desired scratch, the desired shrug, the desired, "You got me, kid." On the other hand, Happy Finnegan was a perfectionist when it came to the finer points of basketball, and Ferguson marveled at how he seethed with indignation whenever a player missed a free throw, the one gimme in the whole damn game, or saw a player drop a neatly fired pass. "Keep your eyes open, fucker, or I'll yank you off the court." He demanded efficient and intelligent play, and even though everyone laughed at him behind his back, the team won most of its games, consistently performing above and beyond its meager talents. Still, Nordstrom and Mashevsky kept urging their friend to go in for a private meeting with the coach. Not that it would necessarily change anything, they said, but they wanted to know why he insisted on starting the wrong man at small forward. Yes, the team was winning most of its games, but didn't Finnegan want to win every game? "A good question," the coach said when Ferguson finally knocked on his door in early January. "A very good question, and I'm glad you asked it. Yes, any idiot can see you're better than Niles. You go up against each other one-on-one, and there'd be nothing left of him but an empty jockstrap and a puddle of sweat on the gym floor. Niles is a lump. You're a Mexican, Ferguson, a goddamn human jumping bean, and you play as hard as anyone I've got, but I need the lump out there on the court. Chemistry, that's what it is. 5-on-5, not 1-on-1, you follow? With those four other guys sprinting around like jazzed-up dots and dashes, the fifth has to be a sack of potatoes, a lump of flesh with sneakers on his feet, a big nobody to fill up space and think about digesting his food. You see what I mean, Ferguson? You're too good. Everything would change if I put you in there. The pace would get too fast, too revy-revy. You'd all have heart attacks and epileptic fits, and we'd start to lose. We'd be a better team, but we'd be worse. Your day will come, kid. I've got plans for you, but not until next year. The chemistry will be different after the dots and dashes fly the coop, and then I'll need you. Be patient, Ferguson. Bust your ass at practice, say your prayers at night, keep your hands off your willy, and everything will work out just so." He was tempted to quit the team right then and there, for what Finnegan seemed to be offering him was no chance to play, no matter what happened for the rest of the season, unless the so-called chemistry began to go wrong and the team stopped winning. But how in good conscience could he root for the team to lose and go on calling himself a loyal member of the team? Still, Finnegan had all but promised him a starting spot for next year. And on the strength of that promise, Ferguson reluctantly swallowed his medicine and held on, working hard to impress Finnegan by busting his ass every day at practice, although he didn't say his prayers at night and couldn't keep his hands off his willy. When the next season began, however, he found himself on the bench again. And the awful thing about it was that there was no one to blame, not even Finnegan, especially not Finnegan. The new boy had turned up out of nowhere, a 6'2" sophomore whose family had moved to Manhattan from Terre Haute, Indiana. And Hoosier phenom Marty Wilkinson was so damned good, so much better than Ferguson and everyone else on the team, that the coach had no choice but to start him at forward. And with the other starting forward back from last year, the solid and dependable Tom Lerner, who had been voted captain of the team, there was no room for Ferguson to crack the first-string lineup. Finnegan made some efforts to increase his playing time, but 5 or 6 minutes a game wasn't enough, and Ferguson felt himself withering on the bench. He had been turned into an afterthought, a combination hatchet man non-combatant, whose skills quietly seemed to be eroding. And the mounting frustration, as he confessed to his mother and stepfather at dinner one night, was killing his spirit. And so it was that 4 games into the season, which happened to fall 4 weeks after Kennedy's assassination, 1 month minus 2 days after that grotesque Friday, when even the skeptical, unduped Ferguson had shed tears along with everyone else, allowing himself to succumb to the general mood of the country without understanding that the murder of the president had been a reenactment of his own father's murder 9 years ago. The full horror of his private grief now played out on a grand public scale. And on December 20th, 1963, a few minutes after the end of Riverside's 4th game, Ferguson went into the coach's office and announced that he was quitting the team. No hard feelings, he said, but he just couldn't take it anymore. Finnegan said he understood, which was probably true, and then the two of them shook hands, and that was that. He wound up playing in a league sponsored by the West Side Y instead. It was still basketball, and he still enjoyed it, but even though he was recognized as the strongest player on his team, it wasn't the same. It couldn't be the same, and it would never be the same again. No more red and yellow uniforms, no more bus rides, no more rebel fanatics cheering from the stands, and no more Chucky Showalter pounding on his bass drum. By the beginning of 1964, the almost 17-year-old Ferguson had published a dozen more film articles under the stewardship of Mr. Dunbar, often with help from Gill on matters of prose style, diction, and the always daunting problem of figuring out exactly what he meant to say and then saying it as clearly as possible. His pieces tended to alternate between American and foreign subjects, an examination of the language in W.C. Fields' comedies, for instance, followed by something on The Seventh Samurai or Pater Panchali, A Walk in the Sun, followed by La Talante, I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, followed by La Dolce Vita. An elemental sort of criticism that was less interested in making judgments about the films than in trying to capture the experience of watching them. Bit by bit, his work was improving. Bit by bit, his friendship with his stepfather had deepened. And the more he went to the movies, the more he wanted to go to the movies. For moviegoing wasn't a hunger so much as an addiction. And the more movies he consumed, the more his appetite for them increased. Among the theaters he went to most often were the New Yorker on Broadway, just 2 blocks from his apartment, the Symphony, the Olympia, and the Beacon on the Upper West Side, the Elgin in Chelsea, the Bleecker Street and Cinema Village downtown, the Paris next door to the Plaza Hotel, the Carnegie next to Carnegie Hall, the Baronet, the Coronet, and Cinemas 1 and 2 in the East 60s, and, following a pause of several months, the Thalia again, where he had yet to run into Andy Cohen after 12 visits. In addition to the commercial theaters, there was the Museum of Modern Art, an indispensable resource for classic films, and now that Ferguson was a member, a present from Gill and his mother when he turned 16, he could go to any and all of those films merely by flashing his card at the door. How many films had he seen in that span between October 1962 and January 1964? An average of 2 every Saturday and Sunday and 1 other on Friday, which came to a total of more than 300. a good 600 hours of sitting in the dark, or the number of clock ticks repeated in the course of 25 consecutive days and nights. And when you subtracted the minutes lost to sleep and various drunken swoons over a month of his waking life during the 15 months that had ticked by. He had also smoked 1,000 more cigarettes, both with and without Amy, and had pursued his love affair with strong spirits by drinking 300 glasses of Scotland's finest product at weekend parties thrown by Terry Mills and his equally dissolute successors the following year, no longer upchucking on rugs when he overindulged, but passing out quietly and contentedly in the corner of the room, single-mindedly pursuing these alcoholic oblivions in order to purge the dead and the damned from his thoughts, having come to the conclusion that unmediated life was too horrible to bear, and that swallowing liquids designed to dull the senses could bring comfort to the troubled heart. But it was important to exercise caution and not go too far, which was why binges were reserved for the weekends, not every weekend, but roughly every other one, and he found it curious that he never craved the stuff unless it happened to be right in front of him. And even then, he found it altogether resistible, but once he took the first drink, he couldn't stop until he had drunk too much. Pot was becoming more and more available at those weekend bashes, but Ferguson had decided it wasn't for him. After three or four puffs, the unfunniest things would start to seem funny to him, and he would dissolve in a fit of giggles. Then he would begin to feel weightless, all silly and stupid inside, which had the unpleasant effect of thrusting him back into some childish incarnation of himself. For even though Ferguson was struggling to grow up just then, falling down as often as he managed to stay on his feet, he didn't want to think of himself as a child anymore. So he shunned grass and stuck to booze, preferring to be plastered rather than stoned, and in that way he could feel he was acting as an adult. Last but not least, that is, first and foremost, he had gone back to Mrs. M's place 6 times in those 15 months. He would have gone more often, but the $25 presented a problem, since his allowance was only $15 a week, and he had no job and no chance of getting one. His parents wanted him to concentrate on his schoolwork, and once he had spent the first 25 in October 1962, his bank account was all but empty until his 16th birthday in March 1963, when his mother wrote him a check for $100 to supplement the gift of his museum membership card, which covered 4 sessions with Julie at the apartment on West 82nd Street. But the other 2 visits were paid for by appropriating things that didn't belong to him and converting them into cash, criminal acts that tormented Ferguson and ate away at his crumbling conscience. But the sex was so important to him, so fundamental to his well-being, so indisputably the only thing that could keep him from cracking apart, that he couldn't stop himself from bartering his soul for a few moments in Julie's arms. God had been dead for years, but the devil had returned to Manhattan and was making a strong comeback in the northern sector of the borough. It was always Julie, because she was much the prettiest and most desirable girl who worked at Mrs. M's. And now that she understood how young Ferguson was, she had thought he was 17 the first time he showed up, not 15. Her attitude toward him had softened into a kind of droll camaraderie as she watched his limbs continue to grow from one encounter to the next. Not that she treated him with anything that could be called tenderness or affection, but she was friendly enough to bend the rules now and let him kiss her on the lips when he wanted to, sometimes even to drive his tongue into her mouth. And the good thing about being with Julie was that she never talked about herself and never asked him any questions beyond how old he was. And other than the fact that she worked at Mrs. M's every Tuesday and Friday, Ferguson knew nothing about Julie's life. Whether she was employed as a prostitute in other houses around the city, for example, or whether the 2 days with Mrs. M were helping to fund her college education, perhaps even at City College for all he knew, where she sat next to Andy Cohen in their Russian literature seminar, or whether she had a boyfriend, or a husband, or a little child, or 23 brothers and sisters, or whether she was planning to rob a bank, or move to California, or eat chicken pot pie for dinner. It was better not to know, he felt, better that it should be about nothing but the sex, which he found to be such deeply rewarding sex that twice during those 15 months, Ferguson was willing to break the law by entering bookstores on the Upper West Side with a woolen coat over his multi-pocketed winter jacket and fill the pockets of both coat and jacket with paperback books, which he then marked up with numerous dog ears and underlinings and sold to a used bookstore across the street from Columbia at 1/4 the cover price, stealing and selling dozens of classic novels in order to earn the extra money he needed to have more sex with Julie. He wished it could have been 60 times instead of 6 times, but just knowing that Julie would be there whenever the urge overpowered him was enough to kill his interest in chasing after the girls at his school. The 15 and 16-year-olds who would have swatted away his curious hands as he struggled to remove their sweaters and bras and panties, not one of them would have marched around naked in front of him as Julie did. Not one of them would have allowed him to penetrate the inner sanctum of her holy womanhood, and even assuming that such a miracle could have come to pass, what work would have been required to achieve what he had already achieved with Julie? And with Julie, there would never be any of the heartbreak that would inevitably come from falling for one of those nice girls, none of whom he loved in any case, only his adored Amy, who didn't go to the Riverside Academy, but attended Hunter High School in another part of town, his lost and rediscovered best-beloved kissing cousin of the unfiltered cigarettes and the mighty laugh. She was the only one worth the effort and the risk, the only girl with whom sex would also mean love, for everything had changed in the past 15 months. The world of his desires had been turned upside down. And one by one, Isabel Kraft and Sidney Milbanks and Vivian Schreiber had all vanished from his thoughts at night. The only two who came to him anymore were the Schneiderman boy and the Schneiderman girl, the ferociously desired Jim and Amy. Every night it was either one or the other who crawled into bed with him, on some nights first one and then the other. And that made sense, he supposed, sense to a person who was cut down the middle and couldn't make sense of who he was, the soon-to-be 17-year-old Archibald Isaac Ferguson, variously known as a whoremongering sex maniac and petty criminal, an ex-high school basketball player and sometime film critic, a twice-rejected lover of his male and female step-cousins, and a devoted son and stepson of Rose and Gil, who both would have dropped dead if they had found out what he was up to. When old man Schneiderman gave up the ghost at the end of February, there was an after-funeral gathering at the apartment on Riverside Drive. A small gathering because Gil's widowed father had made no new friends in the past 20 years, and most of the old ones had already found permanent accommodations elsewhere. A collection of perhaps 24 people that included Gil's daughters, Margaret and Ella, making their first family appearance since the fall of 1959, accompanied by their newly acquired fat, balding husbands, one of whom had made Margaret pregnant, and in spite of his prejudice against them, Ferguson had to admit that his stepsisters showed no signs of hostility toward his mother, which was a lucky thing for them, since nothing would have made Ferguson happier than to stir up a scene and boot them out of the house, a violent impulse that was entirely uncalled for under the circumstances. But after standing out in the cold February weather for close to an hour, as the family laid the old goat to rest, Ferguson was feeling agitated, revy, revy, as Happy Finnegan would have put it, perhaps because he had been thinking about his not-grandpa's hot temper and outspoken contentiousness, or perhaps because every death made him think of his father's death. So by the time the assembled mourners returned to the apartment, Ferguson was feeling wretched enough to down 2 quick whiskies on an empty stomach, which might have contributed to the events that followed. For once the post-funeral gathering began, he wound up misbehaving in a manner so bold and outlandishly inappropriate that that it wasn't clear to him if he had lost his mind or accidentally solved the mystery of the universe. This was what happened. First, everyone present was either standing or sitting in the living room. Food was being eaten. Drinks were being drunk. Conversations were going back and forth between and among pairs and groups of people. Ferguson saw Jim standing in a corner by the front window talking to his father, maneuvered his way into that corner himself, and asked Jim if he could have a word with him in private. Jim said yes, and the two of them walked down the hall and went into Ferguson's bedroom, where, with no word or preamble of any kind, Ferguson threw his arms around Jim and told him he loved him more than anyone in the world, loved him so much he would be willing to die for him. And before Jim could respond, the now 6-foot Ferguson covered the face of the 6-foot 1-inch Jim with numerous kisses. The good Jim was neither angry nor shocked. He assumed that Ferguson was either drunk or gravely upset about something. So he wrapped his arms around his younger cousin, held him in a long, fervent hug, and said, "I love you too, Archie. We're friends for life." Second, half an hour later, everyone present was still either standing or sitting in the living room. Food was still being eaten. Drinks were still being drunk. Conversations were still going back and forth between and among pairs and groups of people. Ferguson saw Amy standing in a corner by the front window talking to her cousin Ella, maneuvered his way into that corner himself, and asked Amy if he could have a word with her in private. Amy said yes, and the two of them walked down the hall and went into Ferguson's bedroom, where, with no word or preamble of any kind, Ferguson threw his arms around Amy and told her he loved her more than anyone in the world, loved her so much he would be willing to die for her. And before Amy could respond, Ferguson kissed her on the mouth, and Amy, who was familiar with Ferguson's mouth because of the many kisses he had given her in the bygone days of their pubescent fling, opened her own mouth and let Ferguson dive in with his tongue. And before long, she had wrapped her arms around her cousin, and the two of them had fallen onto the bed, where Ferguson reached under Amy's skirt and began running his hand up her stockinged leg, and Amy reached into Ferguson's pants and took hold of his stiffened penis. And after each one had finished off the other, Amy smiled at Ferguson and said, "This is good, Archie. We've been needing to do this for a long time." Everything improved after that. Egregious, unacceptable social offenses were apparently not always egregious and unacceptable. For not only had Ferguson managed to open his heart and declare his love to the two Schneidermans, but his friendship with Jim had grown stronger because of it, and he and Amy had become a couple again. The week after the funeral, his mother and Gil gave him $200 for his birthday, but he didn't need the money for Julie anymore. He could spend it on Amy and buy her beautiful lace underwear for the nights when Gil and his mother went out and they had the apartment to themselves, or the nights when Amy's parents went out, or the nights when someone else's parents went out and one of their friends gave them a room to hole up in for a few hours. And how much better things were between them now that he was writing his film articles and Amy could see that he wasn't the dolt she used to think he was. Suddenly she respected him. Suddenly it didn't matter if he was wrapped up in politics or not. He was a film boy, an art boy, a sensitive boy, and that was good enough for her. And what a pleasant jolt it was to discover that neither one of them was a virgin, that neither one of them was afraid, that they had both learned enough by then to know how to satisfy each other. Surely that made all the difference, to be happy in bed with a person you loved and who loved you back. And for a short time, Ferguson walked around feeling that, yes, it was true. By throwing his arms around Jim and Amy, he had unlocked the secret of the universe. It couldn't last, of course. The big love would have to be put aside and perhaps even forgotten, because Amy was a year ahead of him in school and would be going to the University of Wisconsin in the fall. Not to nearby Barnard as originally planned, but to the far-off American tundra, because Amy had decided, after long weeks of tormented soul-searching, that she had to get as far away from her mother as possible. Ferguson begged her not to go there, actually got down on his knees and begged, but the sobbing Amy said she had no choice because she would be strangled and suffocated in New York by her relentlessly interfering mother. And much as she loved her darling Archie, she felt she was fighting for her life and had to go, simply had to go, and couldn't let herself be talked out of it. That conversation was the beginning of the ends, the first step in the slow dismantling of the perfect world they had created for themselves. And because the next day was the start of the weekend when Amy was supposed to make her long-planned trip to Cambridge to visit her brother, Ferguson found himself alone in New York on that Friday night in April. And he, who had not drunk a drop of alcohol since the afternoon of the old man's funeral, and had not attended a single one of his friend's disreputable parties, went to one of those disreputable parties, and drank himself into such a stupor that he overslept the next morning and missed going to school to take the SATs, which had been scheduled to begin at 9 sharp. There would be another chance to take the test in the fall, but his mother and Gil were annoyed with him for being so irresponsible. And though he couldn't fault them for being miffed by his failure to show up for the exam, their anger nevertheless stung far more than it should have. And for the first time in his life, Ferguson was beginning to understand how fragile he was, how difficult it was for him to steer his way through even the smallest conflicts, especially conflicts brought on by his own flaws and stupidities. For the point was that he needed to be loved, loved more than most people needed to be loved, entirely loved without respite through every waking minute of his life, loved even when he did things that made him unlovable, especially when reason demanded that he not be loved. And unlike Amy, who was pushing her mother away from her, Ferguson could never let go of his mother, his unsmothering mother, whose love was the source of all life for him, and merely to see her frown at him with that sad look in her eyes was a devastation, a bullet in the heart. The end came at the beginning of summer, not the fall when Amy would be going to Wisconsin, but early July, which he left on a 2-month backpacking trip through Europe with one of her friends, another whiz-kid hunter girl named Molly Devine. Later that same week, Ferguson left for Vermont. His mother and stepfather had granted him his wish to follow Amy's example and take part in the French immersion program at Hampton College. It was a fine program, and Ferguson's French improved enormously in the weeks he was there, but it was a sexless summer, filled with dread about what was waiting for him when he returned to New York. A last kiss with Amy, and then goodbye. No doubt a definitive goodbye. So there was Ferguson after Amy flew off to Madison, Wisconsin, a senior in high school, with his whole life in front of him, as he was informed by his teachers, his relatives, and every adult he crossed paths with. But he had just lost the love of his life, and the word future had been erased from every dictionary in the world. Almost inevitably, his thoughts turned to Julie again. It wasn't love, of course, but at least it was sex. And sex without love was better than no sex at all, particularly when no books would have to be stolen in order to pay for it. Most of his birthday money was gone by then. He had spent it on lingerie and perfume and linguine dinners with Amy in the spring. But he still had $38 left over, which was more than enough for another tumble in the apartment on West 82nd Street. Such were the contradictions of manhood, Ferguson discovered. Your heart could be broken, but your gonads kept telling you to forget about your heart. He called Mrs. M., hoping to schedule a Friday afternoon appointment with Julie. And though Mrs. M. had some trouble remembering who he was, it had been months since his last visit, he reminded her that he was the kid who had been sitting around in the living room talking to the girls when that cop walked in to collect his weekly envelope and shoot him out of the place. Yeah, Mrs. M. said, I remember you now. Charlie Schoolboy, that's what we used to call you. And what about Julie? Ferguson asked. Can I see her on Friday? Julie ain't here, Mrs. M. said. Where is she? Don't know. Word is she's on smack, honey. I doubt we'll be seeing her again. That's terrible. Yeah, it's terrible, but what can we do about it? There's another black girl here now, much prettier than Julie, more flesh on our bones, more personality. Cynthia, that's your name. Want me to pencil you in? Black girl? What's that got to do with it? I thought you went for black girls. I go for all girls. I just happen to like Julie. Well, if you go for all girls, there's no problem, is there? The stable's full these days. Let me think about it, Ferguson said. I'll call you back. He hung up the phone, and for the next 30 or 40 seconds, he repeated the word terrible to himself 30 or 40 times, struggling not to imagine Julie's limp body as she nodded out somewhere in a drugged-up haze, hoping Mrs. M's information was wrong and that Julie wasn't working there anymore because she had graduated from City College with honors in philosophy and was studying for her doctorate at Harvard. And then his eyes teared up for a moment as an image formed in his mind. Julie lying dead on a bare mattress, naked and stiff in a dingy room at the Auberge St. Hel. A week later, he was ready to give it a shot with Cynthia or anyone else at Mrs. M's establishment who had two arms, two legs, and something that resembled a woman's body. Unfortunately, he had spent the last of his birthday money on a record-buying spree at Sam Goody's and had to resort to less than savory means of acquiring the money. So on a warm Friday afternoon in early October, one day before his rescheduled appointment to take the SATs, he donned his thief's gear of woolen overcoat and multi-pocketed winter jacket and entered a bookstore across from the Columbia campus called Book World, which sounded so much like the burned-down business that had once been Home World that at first he hesitated to go in. But in he went despite his qualms, and as he stood by the paperback fiction section along the southern wall of the store, slipping novels by Dickens and Dostoevsky into his pockets, he felt a hand come crashing down on his shoulder from behind, and then a voice was roaring in his ear, "I've got you, fucker. Don't move." And just like that, Ferguson's book-stealing operation came to a sorry, idiotic end. For what person in his right mind would wear a woolen overcoat on a day when the temperature was 62 degrees outside? They slammed down hard on him and gave him the works. The book-stealing epidemic that had spread across the city was driving many booksellers to the verge of ruin, and the law needed to make an example of someone. And since the owner of Book World was fed up and enraged by what had been happening to his business, he called the cops and told them he wanted to press charges. Never mind that there were only two slender books in Ferguson's pockets, Oliver Twist and Notes from Underground. The boy was a thief and had to be punished. The stunned and mortified Ferguson was therefore handcuffed, arrested, and driven in a squad car to the local precinct house, where he was booked, fingerprinted, and photographed from three angles as he held up a little board with his name on it. Then they put him in a holding cell with a pimp, a drug dealer, and a man who had stabbed his wife. And for the next 3 hours, Ferguson sat there waiting for one of the cops to come back and fetch him so he could be arraigned before a judge. That judge, Samuel J. Wasserman, had the authority to dismiss the charges and send Ferguson home. But he didn't do that because he too felt that someone needed to be made an example of. And what better candidate than Ferguson, a snot-nosed rich boy from a so-called progressive private school, who had broken the law for no reason other than the pure sport of it? The gavel came down. The trial was scheduled for the second week in November, and Ferguson was released without bail, on condition that he remain in custody of his parents. His parents. They had been called, and they were both standing in the courtroom when Wasserman set the date for the trial. His mother cried, emitting no sounds, as she slowly shook her head back and forth, as if not yet able to absorb what he had done. Gil didn't cry, but he too was shaking his head back and forth, and from the expression in his eyes, Ferguson gathered that he wanted to smack him. "Books," Gil said, as the three of them stood at the curb waiting for a taxi. "What in the world were you thinking? I give you books, don't I? I give you all the books you could possibly want. Why the hell did you have to steal them?" Ferguson couldn't tell him about Mrs. M and the apartment on West 82nd Street. Couldn't tell him about the money he was hoping to raise because he wanted to fuck a whore. couldn't tell him about the 7 times he had fucked a vanished junkie whore named Julie, or about the other books he had stolen in the past. So he lied and said, "It's about this thing that's going on with some of my friends, stealing books as a test of courage. It's a kind of competition." "Some friends," Gil said. "Some competition." They all climbed into the back seat of the cab, and suddenly Ferguson felt everything go limp inside him, as if there were no bones left under his skin. He leaned his head against his mother's shoulder and started to cry. "I need you to love me, Ma," he said. "I don't know what I'd do if you didn't love me." "I love you, Archie," his mother said. "I'll always love you. I just don't understand you anymore." In all the confusion, he had forgotten about the SATs he was supposed to take in the morning, and so had his mother and Gil. Not that it mattered much, he said to himself, as the days wore on, for the truth was that the idea of college had lost its attraction to him, and given how much he had always disliked school, the prospect of not going to school beyond this year was something to be taken into careful consideration. The following week, when word got out about Ferguson's run-in with the authorities, the Riverside Academy took it upon itself to suspend him for a month, an action permitted under the bylaws of the code governing student conduct. He would have to keep up with his homework during that time, or else risk being expelled when he returned, the headmaster said, and he would also have to find a job. "What job?" Ferguson asked. "Bagging groceries at the Gristides on Columbus Avenue," the headmaster said. "Why there?" Ferguson asked. "Because one of our parents owns it," the headmaster said, "and he's willing to let you work there during your suspension." "Will they pay me?" Ferguson asked. "Yes, they'll pay you," the headmaster said, "but you can't keep the money. It all has to go to charity. We were thinking the American Booksellers Association might be a worthy recipient. How does that strike you?" "I'm all for it, Mr. Briggs. I think it's an excellent idea." The presiding judge at the November trial, Rufus P. Nolan, found Ferguson guilty as charged and sentenced him to 6 months in a juvenile detention facility. The harshness of the verdict hung in the air for 3 or 4 seconds, seconds as long as hours, as years, and then the judge added, "Sentence suspended." Ferguson's legal representative, a young criminal lawyer named Desmond Katz, asked that the stain of the verdict be expunged from his client's record, but Nolan refused. He had shown remarkable leniency in suspending the sentence, he said, and the good counselor should refrain from pushing his luck. The crime revolted him. As a son of privilege, Ferguson seemed to think he was above the law and that stealing books was nothing more than a lark, whereas his wanton disrespect of private property and cruel indifference to the rights of others showed a callousness of spirit that needed to be dealt with harshly in order to ensure that his criminal tendencies would be nipped in the bud. As a first offender, he deserved another chance, but he also deserved to have this mark on his record, to make him think twice before he ever considered pulling another stunt like this one again. 2 weeks later, Amy wrote to him that she had fallen for someone else, a certain senior classman named Rick, and that she wouldn't be coming home to New York for the Christmas holidays because Rick had invited her to spend that time with him at his family's place in Milwaukee. She said she was sorry to have to break such bad news to him, but something like this was bound to happen sooner or later, and how good it had been during those beautiful weeks in the spring, and how much she still loved him, and how glad she was that they would always be the best cousin friends on earth. She added in a postscript that she was relieved to know he wouldn't be going to jail. "Such a stupid business," she said. "Everybody steals books, but you had to be the one who got caught." Ferguson was disintegrating. He knew he had to pull himself together, or else his arms and legs would start to fall off, and he would spend the rest of the year writhing on the ground like a worm. On the Saturday, after he tore up Amy's letter and burned it in the kitchen sink, he sat through 4 movies in 3 different theaters between the hours of noon and 10. a double bill at the Thalia, and one movie each at the New Yorker and the Elgin. On Sunday, he sat through four others. The eight films were so scrambled in his head that he couldn't remember which was which anymore by the time he fell asleep on Sunday night. He decided that from then on he would jot down a one-page description of every film he saw and keep those pages in a special three-ring binder on his desk. That would be one way of holding on to his life instead of losing it. Plunging into the dark, yes, but always with a candle in his hand and a box of matches in his pocket. In December, he published two more articles for Mr. Dunbar's newspaper, a long one on three non-westerns by John Ford, Young Mr. Lincoln, How Green Was My Valley, The Grapes of Wrath, and a short one on Some Like It Hot, which mostly ignored the story and concentrated on the men disguised in drag and Marilyn Monroe's half-naked body spilling out of her diaphanous dress. The irony was that his suspension from school had not turned him into an outcast. Quite the contrary, it seemed to have elevated his standing among his male friends, who now looked upon him as a daring rebel, a tough hombre, and even the girls seemed to find him more attractive now that he had been officially transformed into a dangerous person. His interest in those girls had ended when he was 15, but he asked a few of them out just to see if they could stop him from thinking about Amy. They couldn't, not even when he took Isabel Kraft in his arms and kissed her, which suggested that it was going to take time, a long time, before he was ready to start breathing again. No college. That was his final decision, and when he told his mother and Gill that he wouldn't be registering to take the SATs in early January, that he wouldn't be sending out applications to Amherst or Cornell or Princeton or any of the other colleges they had been discussing for the past year, his parents looked at him as if he had just announced that he was planning to commit suicide. "You don't know what you're talking about," Gill said. "You can't stop your education now." "I won't be stopping it," Ferguson said. "I'll just be educating myself in a different way." "But where, Archie?" his mother asked. "You're not planning to sit around this apartment for the rest of your life, are you?" Ferguson laughed. "What a thought," he said. "No, I wouldn't stay here. Of course I wouldn't stay here. I'd like to go to Paris, assuming I managed to graduate from high school, and assuming you'd be willing to give me a graduation present that would cover the price of a cheap one-way charter ticket." "You're forgetting the war," Gill said. "The moment you're out of high school, they'll draft you into the army and ship you off to Vietnam." "No, they won't," Ferguson said. "They wouldn't dare." For once, Ferguson was right. 6 weeks after he stumbled his way to the end of high school, having made his peace with Amy, having blessed Jim on his engagement to Nancy Hammerstein, having lived through an unexpectedly warm and comforting springtime affair with his good friend Brian Mashevsky, which had convinced the now 18-year-old Ferguson that he was indeed someone who had been built to love both men and women, and that his life would be more complicated than most other lives because of that doubleness, but also perhaps richer and more invigorating as well. Having written a new article for Mr. Dunbar's paper every other week until the end of the final semester, having added close to 100 pages to his loose-leaf three-ring binder, having worked with Gill to prepare a comprehensive reading list for his first year as a student attached to no college or university, having gone back to the Gristides on Columbus Avenue to shake hands with his former co-workers, having gone back to Bookworld to apologize to the owner, George Tyler, for having stolen the books, having understood how lucky he was to have been caught and not severely punished, having vowed never to steal anything from anyone ever again, Ferguson received his greetings letter from the United States government and was told to report to the draft board on Whitehall Street for his army physical, which needless to say he passed because he was a fit young man with no physical problems or abnormalities, but because he had a criminal record, and because he openly confessed to the staff psychiatrist that he was attracted to men as well as to women. A new draft card was issued to him later that summer with his new classification typed onto the front. 4F. Feckless, frazzled, fucked up, and free.